Big Ben takes the stand.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From APM in New York, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is the Marketplace Midday Update for Tuesday, the 26th of February, a day in which the Federal Reserve Chairman is testifying on Capitol Hill. Ben Bernanke talking about monetary policy and about the economy in general. For more on what he is saying, Marketplace's David Gura joins us from Washington. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So what's the headline, David?
Well, Chairman Bernanke started out talking about GDP. He said that the gross domestic product was flat last quarter, and I realize that may sound bad, like the recovery's at a standstill. But Bernanke told senators that does not appear to reflect a stalling out of the economy. He also talked a bit about jobs. The job market, he said, remains generally weak. He pointed out more than 4 million Americans have been out of work for 6 months or more. And Jeremy, Bernanke brought up something that's been on the minds of a lot of Americans. That's gas prices. They've gone up, of course. And he blamed that on two things, oil prices and the cost of refining fuel. But overall, he said inflation remains low. And he addressed something that's been on the minds of a lot of people here, automatic budget cuts that are set to go into effect on Friday. He said essentially that he's doing his job, but Congress isn't doing its job.
Although monetary policy is working to promote a more robust recovery, it cannot carry the entire burden of ensuring a speedier return to economic health.
Bernanke urged them once again, Jeremy, to replace what he called the sharp front-loaded spending cuts required by the sequestration.
And another thing that a lot of people wanted to hear from him, there was some concern last week when the Fed released its minutes from its latest meeting, and we weren't sure exactly how the policymakers were going to end their aggressive monetary easing. Did he say anything about that?
Yeah, he said something he said many times, that these are not ordinary circumstances. And the goal of buying all these securities, Jeremy, of course, is to push down long-term interest rates. The Fed has done this for several years now, since about 2008. Anyway, Bernanke said that the Fed has the tools to tighten monetary policy when the time comes, and that right now the benefits seem to outweigh the cost.
Well, I'm sure there are going to be a lot of people digging into exactly what those words might mean. Marketplace's David Gura in Washington, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, elections in Italy have ended in gridlock. The poll results from yesterday's election gave no party a clear majority in the Italian parliament. I spoke earlier today about that with the BBC's Mark Duff in Milan.
What Italians have done is snub their noses at the message that's been coming to them from outside. Whilst the outside world, people in Brussels, in New York, in Washington, have been singing the praises of Mario Monti and his fellow Italian, Mario Draghi, who's head of the European Central Bank, Italians are saying they've had enough of austerity because unemployment has been rising. Ordinary families are finding it hard just to make ends meet. And that is the clearest message to take away from a very unclear election outcome.
So what does that election outcome in Italy mean for the European debt crisis in general? Christopher Wirth has that story.
Remember a time not long ago when analysts and pundits predicted the breakup of the euro? The European debt crisis has calmed down a lot in the past few months. But Karsten Brzeski, an economist at ING in Brussels, says a political stalemate means Italy is unlikely to get its financial house in order anytime soon.
These elections are really another painful reminder that the crisis is far from being over.
The uncertainty has already driven up Italy's cost of borrowing. The fear now is that doubt will spread to other euro countries, like Spain. The country continues to grapple with an unemployment rate of 26% as it implements deep budget cuts.
There's a real problem for Spain, which is that people really don't have any trust in the government and in the reform process.
Luis Garicano is with the London School of Economics. He says the elections in Italy are testing the stability of the euro and posing an important question. Does the continent really want the currency at all? I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Well, we are just 3 days away from the sequester, which will cut $85 billion from the federal budget by September. Now, that sounds severe, but as Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports, it's not unprecedented.
So it turns out there are quite a few times, actually, when we've had big spending cuts.
In 1982, there was an agreement to cut spending by $280 billion over 3 years.
John Makin is a resident scholar with the American Enterprise Institute. In current dollars, he says that's double what we're looking at now.
Those spending cuts were sharper over 3 years.
Then it happened again in the 1990s. The government cut defense spending after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Bill Gale is with the Brookings Institution.
The difference, though, is that that was taking place in an economy that could absorb the cuts.
In the 90s, economic growth from the tech boom helped compensate for lower federal spending. Right now, Gale points out, the economy is weak. It's growing, but pretty slowly.
The issue isn't just the size of the spending cuts. It's that we're doing spending cuts at all in this environment.
But John Makin with AEI disagrees.
When is there going to be a good time? We have to recognize that there's this very intrinsic conflict between keeping the economy growing at a good, solid pace and reducing the deficit.
The question of timing aside, what's really different now is how indiscriminate the looming budget cuts are.
It will fall like an axe with no priorities, no nothing. The people will be damned irritated.
Alan Simpson is a former Republican senator. He's been trying, in vain, to forge a political compromise on spending and taxes. He says one thing that won't get sequestered is finger-pointing.
The parties will try to see who to pin the blame on, and that's a great game. But, should be America first, party second. A sick idea.
When it comes to budget cuts, the blame game is something with plenty of historical precedent. I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
For all kinds of industries, the future revenue stream is all about mobile advertising. But Derek Thompson of The Atlantic writes in the latest edition that mobile ads are nowhere near as effective as they need to be. Derek, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, so where are we right now if you were to look at this in the context of the history of mobile advertising? Where are we?
Right. So right now, we dedicate about 1/10 of our attention to mobile ads. But only 1/100 of advertising spending goes to mobile. And so what people see there essentially is this enormous $20 billion gap. And it matters not just because mobile ads are lousy. That's not necessarily a business crisis to us that mobile ads stink. But if you look across history, the last 100 years of news and entertainment has been made possible because advertising worked. And so it is, in fact, a business crisis that advertising doesn't seem to work right now on mobile, which is exactly where our attention is headed.
Why?
Well, there's two reasons. There's a technological reason, and I think there's a cultural reason. The technological reason is that our smartphones are called smart, but the technology on them that tracks us is actually a little bit dumber than we think. Hmm. Our browsers are much smarter at following us around the web.
Our web browsers on our computer are smarter.
On our computer. Our desktops are smarter about knowing who we are than our phones right now. The cultural reason is that, you know, when you're watching television, you expect to have about 3 minutes between segments of Desperate Housewives in order to watch some advertisements.
Right.
And you expect when you're picking up a magazine to flip through and maybe spend some time looking at the beautiful spreads and glamour. But right now, mobile ads are lousy. They are annoying. All they do is just get in our face and keep us from the content we want to read. And it makes us much less likely to engage with them, I think, in a meaningful way.
You know, I have to say, in all the mobile advertising that I experience in my life, the only ones that I actually pay attention to are when I'm listening to Pandora and I hear basically a radio ad for 30 seconds or something like that. I listen to those.
Right. And I think that suggests that we are comfortable with advertising. As much as we think that we spend most of our lives ignoring advertising, we're comfortable with it when it appears in places we're familiar. We're familiar with advertising between songs on the radio,
right,
between segments of a sitcom, between pages of a magazine. We still are uncomfortable with it in mobile. And mobile has to figure out how to give us answers to our questions that are just as good or slightly less good than the answers we're going to try to find in the browser and mobile.
Derek Thompson, business editor for The Atlantic, thank you so much.
It was great to be here.
And finally, to the Oscars, where the Best Picture Award this year went to the film Argo about the Iranian hostage crisis. The award was presented from the White House by First Lady Michelle Obama, who was wearing a sleeveless dress, as she often does. Well, not in the news coverage of one Iranian news agency, which photoshopped sleeves on the First Lady. They actually did a pretty good job. The dress looks real. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.